Okie dokie. Let's start Parashat Vayigash. Let's talk about that some. The Parashat begins with the phrase Vayigash Alav Yehuda, which means, and Judah came near or drew near. And this is, of course, Genesis 44:18. And, you know, the Midrash has lots of things to say about, you know, the fact that he drew near. What does this mean? What does it imply? All that kind of stuff. Why does he have to draw near, you know, to talk to him? We're already in conversation. Why do we have to talk about this? And so it says that he came near and was ready and prepared to do any of three things. He sort of had a list of things that he was ready to do, and these three included: he was prepared for battle, he was prepared to bring appeasement to him in any way that he could, and he's also prepared in prayer. Okay, he was ready to petition Hashem to get what he needed here. So Rabbi Yehuda says that he's prepared for battle based on this similar language, draw near, vayigash, in 2 Samuel 10:13, which says, right here it says, so Joab and the people that were with him drew near to battle. And so that's where they get this, they connect this language here. They're saying, you know, we see this language elsewhere, and so how can we think about what was going through Judah's mind when he was preparing to draw near to Joseph? And then second is for appeasement. He is going to do whatever it takes to appease this, in his mind, remember, this Egyptian basically king. I mean, he's the second most powerful man in the country, if not the world at this point, right? And so he's prepared to appease him any way that he can. And there's a parallel passage in using this language in Joshua 14 and verse 6. This says, then the children of Judah came drew near to Joshua. And so in this instance, it says to conciliate him. They say that based on other passages such as Proverbs 25:11 and Proverbs 20 and verse 5, which, let me see if I wrote those down or if I need to pull from another source. Why didn't I have those? Let me just pull that up real quick. Okay, Proverbs 25:11 says, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. Okay, he was ready to use his words to somehow bring peace and bring appeasement and you know, play on whatever this ruler is wanting, this dictator is wanting. And Proverbs 20 and verse 5 says, counsel in the heart of a man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. And so there's a midrash on both of those. It says, as a wheel shows a front on all sides, so were Judah's words when he spoke to Joseph, logical from all angles. Okay, so basically, you see a wheel and you see all the outer parts of it. You don't really see the insides. And so that's what they're sort of comparing it to. So the Judah's words, you can see all the workings of it or whatever, the outer parts, and you can see it from various angles. And this is what he was prepared to do to him, to show him from every angle his position. And then the second verse about the counsel in the heart of man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. It says, this may be compared to a deep well full of cold and excellent water, yet no one could drink from it. So you have this water here, it's perfect, but some reason nobody can drink from it. It says, then came one who tied cord to cord and thread to thread, drew up its water and drank, whereupon all drew water thus and drank thereof. So somebody came and created a method where the people could draw the water out and everybody could benefit from it. It says, in the same way, Judah did not cease from answering Joseph word for word until he penetrated to his very heart. And so he did whatever he could to make peace and to appease him. Then we have the last one is prayer. And so he's ready to petition the Father for his needs here. There's one other thing in regard to appeasement. It says, "Bi Adoni," in this phrase, "Oh my Lord," it says, "take me," which is, they're playing on words here, "be," not him, "be," says, if you desire a slave to draw water, I'm the man. If you have a need for somebody to serve you, I'm the man. If you need somebody to chop wood, I'm the man. In other words, I'll do whatever it takes. You just, you know, trust that I'm going to take care of whatever it is, and we'll get this resolved, and I'll do whatever it takes. So Judah is trying to work this out. We know the whole plot, you know, that Joseph did, and Joseph had stowed away the silver goblet in Benjamin's pack and all that kind of stuff, and so Judah's trying to beg and plead on behalf of Benjamin because he knows what he'll do to his father, devastate his father, if not kill him. And so he's doing whatever it takes. And so in this phrase, too, he's telling Joseph, he said, "You are like Pharaoh." So we had the beginning of this parashah. It says, "Then Judah went up to him and said, Oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's ears, and let not your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself." He's saying that you have the complete authority and the power of Pharaoh, right? I mean, there's nothing I can do, but you're completely powerful. Well, the rabbis look at it a little bit differently. They look at it maybe as if he was saying this sort of as a subtle jab at him. Okay, so Yeshua says about Herod, he says he calls him a fox, right? In our culture, a fox is somebody who's clever. But in that culture, in Jewish culture, especially the first century, a fox was someone who thought he was something, but he really wasn't. He thought he was bigger than his britches, you know. He really thought he was somebody, but wasn't. And so we have to understand some language in that regard. And so the sages say maybe this was a hint of saying you were like Pharaoh. You think you're Pharaoh, for one. Or two, it says you act like Pharaoh. And a couple of different things they bring out is one, that Pharaoh, he promises, but he doesn't deliver. The second is you act like Pharaoh in the sense that Pharaoh took our grandmother, Sarah, and he was repaid for that with illness, okay? And if you think you're going to take her great grandson, then you're going to have another thing coming, you know, because Hashem is going to really take care of matters, as he did for Sarah. And so there may be a subtle allusion there. We don't know. But then he continues. He says, he tells his whole story, and he relates all this stuff, goes through exactly what had happened, recounting everything as it happened. And then down in verse 32, it says, "For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, if you do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all of my life." Okay? And so the Midrash speaks of the point here. It says, why are you the one speaking for your brothers? Because, you know, Judah is not the eldest, right? Reuben's the eldest. And so why is Judah now all of a sudden the spokesperson for the 12 brothers? And I wrote this down wrong, the reference, I think. But Yeah, I wrote this reference down, so I don't know where exactly it is in the Midrash right here, but it's basically saying that that Judah is the one that, because of this passage right here, he's the one that took responsibility, and therefore he's the one that's going to make sure things happen the way they do, and so therefore he's responsible to lead out and so forth. So he's gonna be the one that's going to make the appeal, and he's going to be the one that's going to do whatever it takes to make sure Benjamin returns home safely, because he made that vow. He made that pledge to his father. This is basically over my dead body. You know, this isn't going to happen. And so he's standing up, and through that, we're going to see some merits that Judah is going to be blessed with. It's actually Reuben. Yep. Reuben said, don't kill him. He says, just throw him in the pit and let us cool down, basically. And then he had to go do something, and then he was gone for a day or so, and he came back, and Joseph was gone. Judah, however, is punished because he should have stood up and he didn't. Remember, because his sons are taken from him. And that's why it interjects his story in the middle of that. So we hear this whole thing playing out between the two. He's begging, let your servant remain instead of the boy. He's basically, you know, I want to give my life on behalf of his, and because this is going to break my father's heart, it's going to kill him. Don't know what's going to happen to him. And then chapter 45, this is when the whole thing sort of comes out. Joseph could not control himself before all who stood by him. He cried out, make everyone go out from me. So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, so the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. And we could camp out here for a long time. There's a midrash, before we go to this, there's a midrash that talks about, and I don't know why, it's like I copied and pasted and put the wrong references on these things. So let me find it real quick. Okay. The Midrash sort of takes some liberties here and tells this maybe a behind-the-scenes story that could have gone on. And he says, as soon as he mentioned his father's grief, he could not master himself. So he summoned all of his strength, and he said to his brothers, he said, where is your brother who you said is dead? He demanded, where is he? He says, are you certain that he's dead? Well, they replied, yes. He says, well, why do you speak so falsely? Why are you lying to me? He says, did you not sell him to me, and I bought him from your hands? He says, hang on, let me call him, and he'll answer me. Joseph, son of Jacob, Joseph, son of Jacob, he calls out. And they looked around the house looking for him to come out. And he says, what do you see? And they don't have a response. And that's when he says, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph, your brother. It says, but they did not believe him until he uncovered himself and showed that he was circumcised. And so he revealed himself to his brothers, literally. So, TMI. And so that's a midrash there. The sages also say that this was a veiled rebuke, okay? He said it in a gentle way, I am Joseph, to soften the blow on them, okay? He could have easily said, I'm Joseph, the one you betrayed, right? But he cut it short. He just said, I'm Joseph. And he let those words sink in, right? Of course, we have the whole thing that we've been discussing over the last several weeks of the parallels between Joseph and Yeshua, and a lot of discussion on Facebook today, and especially with the, I'm assuming you guys have heard the Vatican's...
I saw in the post you put, but I didn't read it.
Yeah, so the Vatican has released a paper, a position on Jews. So basically their whole thing is, we are not going to, as a body, as a congregation, I mean as a entity, we're not going to try to convert Jews anymore. We're stopping. We believe that there's a mystery of our connection based on Romans. Right. Right. And somehow you know, God's working something within them parallel as with us, and we can do is say what Romans, I think it's 11:29, says that his callings are without repentance on the Jewish people. He has called them and he uses them, and salvation is from the Jews. And it's just amazing, you know. And they admitted it's a mystery. We don't know how to think. I mean, at least it's a step forward. And now they got to figure out, you know, what we know about some of the things in that covenant, you know, promises that God made with them and their relationship with the Torah and so forth. Anyway, that whole concept that they don't know Yeshua for who he is because he's been dressed like a Greek. He's been dressed like a Gentile for the last 2,000 years. And it's time that he's going to begin revealing himself. And he's going to start, you know, taking off his Egyptian garb, so to speak, and say, Ani Yeshua, right? And his brothers are going to recognize him for who he is. And we see that more and more and more. Yep.
And they're going to see him.
Yep.
And then we ain't going to have to do anything. We just basically get to sit back and enjoy the ride.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I agree. Also, the Orthodox Union came out with a statement like prior to the Catholic statement that basically gave a new position on them in relationship to Christianity, basically. It said you know, they wanted to work alongside our Christian brothers and sisters towards, you know, reconciliation and all that kind of stuff. So there's some stuff going on.
What if they totally blew up every prophetic teaching and all of a sudden he just shows up and the eyes start getting
out? Yep. Yep.
There's so many different possibilities.
There is. But this right here is, again, a beautiful picture of what's going to happen. Somehow, some way, he's going to say, Ani Yeshua. And they will go, holy cow. Maybe not those words, but something like it, you know. Yeah, oy vey. Right. And there you go. Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, exactly, right. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So we have the whole situation. Joseph, you know, he's just revealed himself to his brothers. They're, you know, in disbelief. Of course, they just cannot believe that his brother, that their brother, is one alive, but two, he has their lives in the very power of his hands. And I'm sure they remembered his dreams at that point, as the 11 of them were bowing down. And they began, you know, working through this stuff. Of course, Joseph, incredible humility and trust in Hashem and knowing that he works all things for the good. He says, do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. God sent me. Can you believe that? I mean, that's just, you know, as many times as we read that, it's just still so powerful. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all of his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry up and go to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen. You shall be near me, you and your children, your children's children, your flocks, your herds, and so forth. Which brings me sort of back to our first statement. When he first reveals himself, he not only says, I am Joseph, but he says, is my father still alive? Why would he ask that? He's already asked them that a few times before, right? Why would he ask them that? Well, they say that the reason he asked them this time is because before he had asked them under interrogation as spies, and they would have probably given him any answer that he wanted to hear. This time, he's asking, is my father really, really still alive? I cannot believe it. I want to see him. You know, you can just hear his heart just wrenching through the words. And so, if I can keep this thing on my head. So he, of course, calls for his father, sends down for his father. Of course, Jacob can't believe he's alive. You know, he's like, what? You're joking me. You want me to have a heart attack? You know? And it's not nice to tease old men. And they proved it. I mean, they had camel after camel after camel after camel filled with the best of Egypt, you know? And they told him the story and so forth. And then says, let me see where it is here. Beginning in chapter 46, it says, so Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba. Why do we have to know that? He came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac.
That's where, Isaac is.
Say again. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I know that Abraham dwelled in Beersheba for a long time, remember, after he offered Isaac up on Mount Moriah. It says that he and his young men went and dwelled in Beersheba. They dug the wells, and so Isaac dwelled there and so forth. And so it's the land of the fathers right there. And so the Midrash says this is interesting because of several things, but one of the things it talks about is that we hear this terminology, he offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. And, you know, this is, I think back here, let me see if I can find it real quick. I think this is how it, similar to what it's phrased when he offers up offerings at Bet-El as well. Let me pull back here. Okay. And I thought it was in chapter 31. Let me see. I don't remember where exactly it is. Let me see. Because he wrestles with the angel in 32. I thought it was right before that. Okay, I'm not going to find it. I think it may be in 35, but I'm not going to spend more time on it. So anyway, he offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac, okay? So he offered the sacrifices on the merits of his father, Isaac. The rabbi said, which is interesting, let me pull this out, and they don't say a lot on it, but this is interesting language here. It says, we look upon him, referring to Isaac, as though his ashes were heaped in a pile on the altar. So they look to the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, the offering up of Isaac, even though he did not actually die, as if he actually were offered up. And so that right there plays into other Midrashim, particularly one called, I think it's Pesikta de Rebbe Eliezer, and in that particular account, it talks about, it says that Isaac actually did die. It says, when he put the knife to his throat, he didn't slit his throat, but at that point, his soul left his body, his spirit left his body, and he was dead, and then he was resurrected. And so you have this sort of neat parallel with Yeshua within rabbinic literature itself, not a Christian document, not a messianic document or whatever, that looks upon Isaac as an actual offering and having merits for this deed, which is very interesting. Okay, last couple of things we're going to talk about is when Jacob goes down to Egypt. After this, he heads out from Beersheba. And then it says, and then Jacob set out from Beersheba. The sons of Israel carried Jacob, their father, their little ones, their wives, and wagons that Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they also took all these other things along with them. And then we read down further, if I can get these pages apart. It says, verse 26 of chapter 46, and the persons belonging to Jacob who came into Egypt, who were his own descendants, not including Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came into Egypt were 70. So, let's go back through this again. It says, everybody except for Joseph and his sons was, how many? 66. Then Joseph's sons made it 68. Joseph, 69. But wait a minute. It says, all the persons in the house of Jacob who came into Egypt were 70. Then we are, right, because she's already there. She's from there. So, 70. Where does the number 70 come from? We are missing a person somewhere. So, this could play into the little legend that we talked about last week, maybe Dina, Asenat, the daughter of Dina, coming down to Egypt and then marrying Joseph, which if she is or not, we don't know. This is just one legend. But we also have a much stronger legend that says the 70th soul or the 70th person was Jochebed, the mother of Moses. She was conceived in Canaan, but she was born in the city gates once they got to Egypt. She was born in the gates of Egypt. And it's interesting if you do the genealogies of how soon she appears in the genealogies of those who are in Egypt. Okay, she is, we often think, I think we've hit this last couple weeks or whatever, we often think of the time of enslavement being 400 years or plus because we interpret that passage that God spoke to Abraham about the 400 years and 430 years in another passage. And then actually the New Testament talks 450 years. But we think of that as 400 years of enslavement. Well, it only ends up to being about 210 years. And so that's not very many generations. And so especially living as long as they did at this point, people, you know, normally live in 100 plus years. And so Yocheved, she quickly appears in the story, in the genealogy. And so they're saying that she was the 70th soul that came down to Egypt, but she was actually born in Egypt as they were crossing into Egypt. Okay, the very last, which very interesting, I wish I could convey it as well as it needs to be, but interesting topic here is in the very next verse, actually, that we read here in chapter 46, it says, "He had sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to show the way before him in Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen." Okay, so Jacob sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to show him the way to Goshen. So, from this, there becomes a long discussion in the Midrash over the resurrection. And let's see if I can connect it here. It says, "And he sent Judah before him to Joseph." This illustrates the verse in Isaiah 65:25, "And the wolf and the lamb shall graze together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, and the dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord." Okay, the Midrash connects these passages. And I'm pretty sure what's going on here, because of the previous Midrash, is that Judah and Joseph are basically competitors. Judah is, remember when he's confronting Joseph, when the Midrash goes into a lot of this of how he was mighty and strong and so forth. And it's sort of humorous at some points, you know, because their stories talked about what Judah does and what Manasseh does and so forth. And they're like these, you would think that they were like superheroes or like the Incredible Hulk or something like that. It says, you know, they stomped their feet and the people's teeth fell out, you know, and stuff like that. He stomped his feet and the furrows, you know, shot out in front of him in the ground. And he screamed or clapped his hands and, you know, their ears burst or, you know, just different stories like that. And so you have this competition of power. And one of the telltale signs, supposedly, that they recognized Joseph was that he had equal strength to the family of Jacob. And so in this, you have this sort of a power struggle, adversarial, you know, type struggle here. And so in this, when it's he's sending Judah ahead of him to Joseph, it is as if the wolf was coming to the lamb, and they were going to be now united and be at peace with one another. Judah being the wolf and Joseph being the lamb. There's another version that says maybe that Benjamin is represented by the wolf, you know, based on later the blessings of the blessings of Jacob on Benjamin. But then it continues. Some very interesting stuff. It says, "Come and see how all whom the Holy One blessed be he who has been smitten in this world, he will heal in the future that is to come." In other words, let me explain how everyone who suffered in this world, they're going to be resurrected and healed in the world to come. They're going to be healed in the resurrection. They're not going to have pain, suffering, and all that kind of stuff. Okay? It says, "The blind will be healed. As it says, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened," in Isaiah. "The lame, as it said, then shall the lame man leap as a hart," or like a deer. "The dumb, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing." So all these prophetic passages of what's going to happen and transpire, right? So you can have the blind are going to be seeing, the lame are going to be walking, and the dumb are going to be talking, and not only talking, but singing. It says, thus all shall be healed except for the one who departs. Let me get this right, because this is, let me just read it literally. Thus all shall be healed, save that as a man departs this life, so will he return resurrected. Okay, so this is what they mean. So if you were born either lame, blind, or dumb, then you will be resurrected, healed. But if you were injured in this world, you're going to come back just the same. And there's a reason for that. You're not going to be healed. And this is just, of course, speculation. Because it says, if he departs blind, he will return blind. If he departs deaf, he will return deaf. If he departs dumb, he will return dumb. If he departs lame, he will return lame. As he departs clothed, so he will return clothed. As it says, it is changed as clay under the seal, and they stand as in a garment, according to Job 38:14. Now, it says, where do we learn this from? From Samuel the Ramathite. When Saul brought him up from the dead, what did he say to the woman? He says, what form is he? In other words, what does he look like? And she said, an old man comes up, and he is covered with a robe. This is from 1 Samuel. It says, for even so was he clothed in life. In other words, this is the way he was dressed when he died. Moreover, his mother made him a little robe, according to this passage in Samuel previously. Why does a man return as he went? In other words, why? Why is somebody going to, you know, die with, say, a maimed hand, a lame hand or whatever, and then be resurrected with that lame hand and not be completely healed? I thought that's the whole purpose of the resurrection. It says, so that the wicked of the world should not say, after they died, God healed them and then brought them back. Apparently, these are not the same, but others. So they're saying that if they were made to be resurrected, completely healed, they would claim that these weren't the same people, right? Which makes me think of Yeshua's resurrection. Was he completely whole at his resurrection? No. He still had the scars of the nails in his hands and in his feet to prove that he was who he was. And this is the same premise they're using for this. It's not that there's lack of compassion, but maybe there'll be some extra grace afforded to them, but it's to prove the resurrection power, that it's legitimate, because there will be people living that will witness that resurrection and want to deny it. Very interesting. Yep. So, I'd not either, but I thought it was very, very interesting that it says, let them arise in the same state in which they went, and then I will heal them. So, evidently, this is saying, basically, let them be resurrected with their infirmaments. Let them prove the resurrection, and then I'm going to heal them. Then I'll heal them. And so there's going to be, according to this theory, there's going to be a resurrection, but the work of healing will be incomplete until the resurrection is verified. And then once it's verified, then he'll bring completely healing to all those who have need of healing, which is, I think, pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, interesting. Especially, you know, connecting it to why Yeshua, you know, resurrected and still had those scars. So, anyway, just a thought. But I thought that was pretty neat.